Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. When I was writing my book, Sex RX, Hormones, Health, and Your Best Sex Ever, I decided to devote an entire chapter to the history of the vibrator, based on a fascinating book I'd read titled The Technology of Orgasm. The author, Rachel Maines, described how in the 1800s, vibrators were not sexual items that women bought for themselves, but medical devices used by doctors to treat a medical condition then known as hysteria. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. The word hysteria dates back to 300 BC, when Hippocrates, of Hippocratic Oath fame, described hysteria as suffocation or madness of the womb, resulting from sexual deprivation. Fast forward to Victorian times, when the word hysterical had nothing to do with something funny or becoming uncontrollably emotional. Like in Hippocrates' time, it was all about medical conditions stemming from the uterus. Specifically, it was believed that a, quote, sick womb could cause disturbances such as anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, fainting, shortness of breath, and in its most severe form, insanity. Some women were accused of having hysteria if they didn't obey their husbands or if they rejected traditional womanly roles. Women were advised to placate their angry uterus by having babies, being submissive, not educating themselves, not expressing their opinions, and most importantly, letting the men run the show. It wasn't long before treatments to restore uterine health were proliferating. Many hysterical women were sent off for rest cures, in which they were submitted to isolation and sensory deprivation for extended periods of time. If they weren't hysterical at the beginning of the cure, they were generally truly hysterical by the end. The other popular cure for hysteria, according to my reading in The Technology of Orgasm, was to sexually stimulate a woman to orgasm. The rationale was that an orgasm, or paroxysm as it was called then, would cause the sick uterus to be restored to health. Ideally, this orgasm would be produced by intercourse in the marriage bed. So single women who suffered from hysteria were told to marry. Married women were encouraged to spend more time in bed with their husband. Not every case of hysteria responded to more sex. And then there were those hysterical women who had no husband. So the doctor was obligated to step in and elicit orgasm by massaging a woman's genitals in his office. As you can imagine, this therapy was time-consuming and exhausting for the poor physician, especially when women would return week after week for additional treatments. Necessity is the mother of invention, and by the mid-1800s, a number of innovative devices were invented so that the doctor no longer had to use his hand to treat those hysterical patients. One of the first of these devices that was documented in 1843 was the French water jet massage treatment. The hysterical woman would sit in a chair and a jet of water would be directed at her clitoris until orgasm was reached. Those water systems never became popular. They were expensive, cumbersome, and not practical for most doctors' offices since a special water chamber with pipes and a warmer was required. So the search for easier methods continued. Now, keep in mind that in the mid-1860s, electricity wasn't an option, but there was steam. And in 1869, a hysterical woman would lie face down on a manipulator table with a hole conveniently cut out to expose her pelvis in order to have her genitals massaged by a steam-operated paddle. According to Dr. George Taylor's published report of a typical patient, quote, Mrs. Y was reared with the utmost tenderness, carefully shielded from every demand and from the rough side of the world. At 20, she was married. 8 years later, she became my patient, confined to bed for 2 years, suffering various conditions of the pelvis. But after the massage process, she was able to resume her place as the mistress of her house. Phew, a real success story. The Technology of Orgasm went on to report that in 1880, the first electric vibrator became part of the treatment option for doctors who were exhausted from manually manipulating women, and after that, electric vibrators were routinely used in physicians' offices. One of the advantages of the electric vibrator was how fast it could do the job. Manual massage required not only skill, but time. Time is money. An electric vibrator induced orgasm in less than 4 minutes, sometimes quicker. Electrical treatment of hysteria was effective, efficient, and extremely lucrative, since severe cases required multiple treatments a week. Truly a fascinating history. So fascinating that a popular play in the next room was based on it, followed by a movie, Hysteria. Multiple other articles and books other than mine retold the story. Except almost nothing I just told you is true. My guest today, historian Dr. Haley Lieberman, is the author of Buzz, A Stimulating History of the Sex Toy, in which she busts the myth that Victorian doctors routinely treated their patients using an electric vibrator to bring them to orgasm. So welcome, Dr. Lieberman.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for, you know, challenging this myth, because it's been like the bane of my existence.
It lives on. You know, I first read Buzz about 5 years ago, and that's when I learned that I had all the wrong information in my own book, and I was horrified. I mean, not just my book, but I'd given multiple lectures recounting that story. I bet you hear that a lot.
I do, and, you know, it's frustrating, but it's also like great that you and others are willing to say, hey, I'm going to adjust what I'm saying based on the research that's coming out, because not everyone is willing to do that.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to say I'm wrong when I'm wrong, and I was wrong. Okay, so let's get to the bottom of this whole thing. You know, over the last couple of days, I reread Buzz, and everyone should read it. It is so good. And you really start, you know, in the Ice Age with dildos and sex toys. And we're not going to do all that because we just don't have the time today. But it is worth noting that sex toys have been present for eons and even make a guest appearance in the Bible. But we're going to skip thousands of years and go straight to the 1800s so we can focus on the vibrator. And let's go to that period of time and that myth that I've been talking about from Rachel Maine's 1999 book, The Technology of Orgasm. So my first question for you is, prior to doing your own research, had you read her books? I mean, did you buy into the belief that doctors were using electric vibrators in the office as a treatment for hysteria?
Absolutely. Like, it was the only book. I was fascinated by sex toys. I was interested in studying them, and it was the only book out there. So I read it. I was like, wow, what a story. This sounds like porn, like vibrators giving, you know, doctors giving women orgasms with vibrators in the doctor's office. Like, this is crazy.
It was written in such an academic way that you thought, oh, okay, well, this actually was happening, right?
Right. Johns Hopkins University Press. I mean, very well.
I can't believe Johns Hopkins. Who can you believe?
Exactly.
All right. So what was your tip off that it wasn't true?
The tip off only came in grad school, because I had an assignment in a class, and it was looking through, choose a book that you're using for your research and look through and look at all the citations and check them. You know, use Google Books, use the library, use whatever you can to check to see what the citations are and how the historian has interpreted the data. And I thought I was doing the research wrong, because none of the citations didn't match up with what was being said. And I was a grad student, and I asked the professor, I'm like, I think I'm doing this wrong, misinterpreting it. He's like, no, this is actually a finding. Like, this is showing that, you know, it's not reflecting the data.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting, because I collect old medical textbooks. I've always had this passion for the history of medicine. And I have a textbook that was published in 1909 titled Electricity and Gynecology. And when I read it, when I got it, I read every page, and I was looking for some mention of hysteria or using vibration on the genitals. And there was no mention. So what you were finding was true, that while vibrators, and we're going to talk about this more, were used to treat many medical conditions like endometriosis and uterine prolapse, they weren't being used to treat sexual conditions in women. Because if it wasn't in a 1909 book on electricity and gynecology, That's pretty telling right there.
Absolutely. And so they were, and I'm glad you pointed out, they were used to treat other things, including endometriosis, including breast cancer, which they called caked breast.
Yeah.
But it was never considered legit. Like once doctors looked into it, it was not, they saw that the treatments were not legitimate.
Right. And they said this is just their word for the placebo effect back then, you know, that this is just all in their head. Okay. So let me ask you this. So now we know this whole thing wasn't true. And in an article that you wrote for the New York Times a few years ago, you stated that, you know, what were the reasons for this widespread acceptance of the Rachel Maines research, other than it was from Johns Hopkins and it sounded very sciencey? But you made the case that people believed it because of gender bias. Can you explain about that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So people believed, like in my article, I flipped it. If men were being masturbated to orgasms in doctors' offices by women, no one would ever think that men were misunderstanding their ejaculations as a medical treatment. But when we flip the genders, when we tell this story about women, our belief that women are so desexualized, so out of tune with their bodies, that men and doctors know their bodies better than they do, our belief that persists today in some ways, unfortunately, led us to buy into this myth that, okay, women don't understand, you know, what an orgasm is. So, you know, our great grandmothers didn't. So in the doctor's office, if the doctor was putting something on their clitoris and they were having an orgasm, they just wouldn't understand it. And so it's like this almost misogyny and idea that women are not in control of their own bodies.
Yeah. Okay. But you know, what's interesting about that is I get it. I understand you and I see where you're going with this, but the truth is a lot of women are absolutely not in control of their own bodies. They don't know. They expect to have an orgasm during intercourse. They don't know that they require clitoral stimulation in order to have an orgasm. So in fairness, you know, to that time, a lot of women really didn't understand that. So yes, gender bias, no question, but there was also a little bit of truth to that.
That is fair. And I think that's why it caught on, because in a way, like it was believable.
Right.
Like it was believable that women may, you know, because women, even in their 30s and 40s today, some have never had orgasms and some don't understand it, you know, what their own bodies. And so, yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why it caught on.
But the other reason it caught on is just like you said before, it was a great story. It was a fascinating story. So in that same article, you stated that Rachel Maines said, as a response to the criticism, well, I never intended it to be seen as established fact. I just put it out as an interesting hypothesis. What was your reaction when she said that?
That was very frustrating, because if you read her book, it's not an interesting hypothesis.
No.
It's presented as
settled science, you know?
Settled science, historical truth. So I think that argument, like, you know, if it was disingenuous, like just admit, like, hey, I messed up, or new research has come out and this is inaccurate. Like, instead of saying, I never said that, like, it's kind of absurd.
All right. So did she get anything right? I mean, was hysteria an accepted condition back during Victorian times?
That was, I mean, accepted, maybe. It existed, but it was also, I mean, there were parts missing from her book. Like, hysteria was considered a men's medical health condition as well.
Right.
Men were diagnosed. It wasn't just a female thing. I don't think hysteria was as widespread as the book made it out to be.
No, it made it sound like it was an epidemic.
Exactly. And I don't think that, you know, people were using, so they did use vibrators for hysteria, just not on their genitals.
Yeah.
One of 350 conditions that vibrator manufacturers were urging people to use to cure.
And they were also selling products. But let me ask you this. You know, I had mentioned earlier the steam-operated vibrator and the water device, which was used to treat hysteria by, you know, putting the steam and the water on the clitoris, on the genitals. So that was real, right? We have documentation of that.
Absolutely. So I think the difference or the issue that comes to the fore is where people were using them on genitals and what they were using them for. Mm-hmm. Because you see in medical literature, doctors going, don't put this on the clitoris. It's like the exact opposite of the argument, because women will get turned on their husband's, their marital bed. They won't have fun in the marital bed anymore. Like those were the terms they were right. using. So we have this knowledge, like the main argument is predicated on this knowledge that, you know, doctors weren't quite understanding the clitoris either. No one was getting the clitoris. And medical literature shows that, yet that people did understand the clitoris. And maybe some women didn't, but medical doctors certainly did.
Yeah. You know, and just to be clear, I mean, the electric vibrator did exist. It was invented, what, in 1880s? That guy, mm-hmm. Mortimer Granville, I think is his name. But it wasn't used to elicit an orgasm. It was used to address all kinds of medical problems. I think he thought it was something about a nervous system that had, you know, was having difficulty. So what kinds of conditions were they used for, if not sexual?
So what's interesting is like they were used for nearly every condition. Like I mentioned before, people try, it was a new tool and they were like, okay, what are we going to do? Use it for? Let's do back massage. Let's the attachments to put on the ear for ocular issues for in the, I mean, not, I said it, ear and then touch my eye.
but we can't see that. So you're good.
So you can't see it. So for the eye for ocular issues, the ear for hearing issues, they were also used for sciatica. And that has maybe some kind of basis. Like people are using like Theraguns now for that kind of stuff. So there were lots and lots of conditions, indigestion. And it was like, vibrator manufacturers were promoting it this way, throwing against the wall, seeing what would stick, kind of like, you know, apple cider vinegar, like it cures, it was a panacea that cures everything.
Yeah.
And doctors started using them and realized it didn't really work for most of these conditions. Like maybe it could help your back pain a little bit, but it's not going to cure cancer. It's not going to cure, you know, measles.
But the vibrator was also used in men on their genitals to treat erectile dysfunction, which back then was known as impotence, right?
Yeah, that's a huge part that's left out of her story. Like actually Mortimer Granville, the inventor of the electric vibrator, wrote, hey, you know, don't use this on women, but actually you can use it on men to vibrate their perineum, which is the area between the genitals and the anus, if they have impotence. So he clearly said, like, you can use this on men for an erection. And it was kind of amazing that use was one of the ones he suggested.
Yeah. You know, were physicians even aware, though, that when using a vibrator for one of these other conditions, that it might, quote, inadvertently cause sexual excitement or an orgasm? I mean, there was some acknowledgement of that, correct?
Yes, there's acknowledgement of it, and there were instructions to not do that because women would get too excited. It was like the opposite. And there were doctors who got in trouble for actually using. So like it was used sexually in a handful of cases, and these doctors got in trouble.
Yeah.
And they said, do not do this.
Okay, so let's kind of talk about when things turn from using a vibrator to just to, quote, treat other medical illnesses and for sexual stimulation. Because the thing about the Victorian era, I think, as we all know, is that masturbation was frowned upon. Women were discouraged from horseback riding or even traveling on trains since the motion might cause some excitement. Yet, in the early 1900s, the vibrator left the doctor's office and popped up in women's magazines, you know, all these ads for home vibrating devices, and even made it to the 1918 version of Amazon, the Sears Roebuck catalog. Mm. But they weren't framed as sexual devices, right? They were framed as, you know, things to use around the house. I mean, the one in the Sears Roebuck catalog says compact vibrator complete with attachments for churning, mixing, beating, grinding, buffing, and operating a fan. So, okay. What was the intention here? Was the intention that women should buy this vibrator for health reasons or as a time-saving household appliance? Or was this really a sexual device and everybody knew it, masquerading as a household appliance, since obviously advertisers couldn't say it was for sex? What was going on there?
Well, that's the big question. Did anyone know it? No one wrote about masturbation in their diaries, or at least not back then, probably not today, even today. So whether people knew it or not is hard to prove. What we do know, though, is when you look at these ads at the time period, they stand out. Like, these ads for vibrators were all over the New York Times. Now, you go to New York Times website, you do not see any ads for vibrators. But one of the ways they were able to advertise and show possibly sexual sides of it is you have women in low-cut outfits who are, you know, looking suggestive. They've got cleavage and they're like, I'm curing indigestion, and they're kind of winking towards the camera. So you had stuff like that that was telling the consumer, hey, there's something beyond that. So yes, they were not explicit, but I think consumers knew. They also had ads for their phallic, with the phallic attachment, there was a drawing of it among a bunch of different attachments. So it looked like a dildo was in the ad, but just a very small dildo.
Yeah. You know, you have a picture of that 1912 Hamilton Beach vibrator ad that advertises, yeah, it's going to cure your deafness and help with indigestion. But then, of course, you've got a young woman, like you said, who's in lingerie and grasping her vibrator in one hand and holding the plug suggestively in the other hand. So, yeah, I'm my Substack, I'm going to have to put some of these ads because they're just amazing. And it really does tell the story. So I think clearly there was this hidden message, not so hidden, that, yeah, we're saying it's to cure your deafness, but it's really for sex, to masturbate.
Right. There is that message there. And there was, you know, there was also evidence in newspapers like that people were using them in sexual ways, like in the bathtub, like multiple women died using plug-in vibrators in the bathtub because they didn't understand.
I never knew that. Well, I wonder what they told the family when they found them with a smile on their face, but, you know, dead.
Right.
Oh my God. You know, but I think what's so interesting is how mainstream it became. And I read someplace, I don't remember where, if it's true, but that in 1917, there were more vibrators than toasters in American homes. And I also read that even Mark Twain owned one, you know, evidently a gift from his mistress. So they were out there. Everybody had them, and evidently they were using them for whatever.
Right. That what is crazy is that they were in some ways more mainstream than they are now. They certainly were advertised more widely. You had celebrities. You had this woman, an actress who starred in Lifeboat, Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat, in ads for vibrators. And like, you wouldn't see like the equivalent, like Nicole Kidman in a vibrator ad today. Like you would not. I mean, maybe a few years from now, she's far enough away from Tom Cruise to not have to worry. But like, yeah. You know, we were more open about it when the sexual uses were underground.
Yeah. You know, so, okay, let's move forward a little bit. By 1920, I think it's, well, vibrators were definitely in porn movies and all that, but they kind of started to disappear from the mainstream for roughly the next, 100 years or so. And it wasn't, though, until 1952 that the American Psychiatric Association finally eliminated using hysteria as a legitimate medical term, which just kind of boggles my mind. But what I want to talk about is what was going on legally and politically in the late 1870s, early 1900s, that really made it very difficult to advertise vibrators and own a vibrator.
So yeah, we had the Comstock Act then, which by the way is still on the books and Republicans are currently talking about.
I'm
telling someone, yeah, and it's totally depressing. But the Comstock Act banned ads for contraceptives, banned ads for sex toys, and banned sending sex toys and contraceptives through the mail. And they called sex toys immoral articles, immoral rubber articles a lot of times.
And they called contraceptives feminine hygiene, which was the workaround to sell things to prevent pregnancy. And which is kind of funny because feminine hygiene has taken on a whole new meaning today. But yeah, but this all comes from the Comstock Act.
Yes, It does.
Okay, so there, so we have, you know, the Comstock Act, which is really limiting the ability to sell a vibrator, to mail a vibrator. So what were some of the strategies that were used to sell them? Because we know that they were being sold. It was just a lot more difficult.
Yeah. And so when you have a law like that, basically the way to get around it, and you see this today, by the way, on social media, on TikTok, Instagram, similar strategies, which is sell it as a health aid. Sell this for facial rejuvenation, for wrinkles as well. So sell it for health and beauty and sell it as an appliance. And if you are using, you know, selling it for a legitimate health concern, there were less fears about it and it was able to slide through. You couldn't do that with dildos. Dildos, it was hard to say that, you know, oh, use this dildo to reduce your wrinkles, like hit your face with it.
Right, that's not going to work. Shaped object is yeah. Not gonna, yeah.
But you could do that with vibrators.
Yeah. You also mentioned that the ad copies, while they were talking about health and wellness, they would use words like, you know, quiver, penetrate, stimulate is kind of like code for, we know what you're really going to do with this.
Exactly. They knew the words. It was like, oh, you're stimulating the blood in your veins to have, you know, a paroxysm or whatever it's saying. Like, you know, consumers weren't dumb. They could read between the lines when you have that, you know, text mixed with a woman cupping her breast. People knew what was going on.
Yeah. All right. So now let's fast forward a little bit because we have this whole period of time where while vibrators were available, they were certainly not necessarily easy to get. And then along comes Betty Dodson. So tell us who Betty Dodson was and what her whole role was in this story.
Yeah, Betty Dodson was an amazing woman. She was an artist. She was born in Kansas, got in the 20s, got no sex education, like everyone, like, you know, no one did at the time. When she turned 29, she thought, uh-oh, I'm going to be an old maid if I don't marry someone. I better marry someone. So she marries this guy. They have sex and she doesn't have an orgasm. And she just masturbates to orgasm. She rolls on her side and masturbates to orgasm again and felt masturbates to orgasm and feels incredibly guilty. So she, you know, is masturbating and feeling awful about it, finally meets this lover, gets a divorce, thinks, you know, wow, I'm just going to be like an old maid. Like, this is terrible. Meets this lover who tells her, she finally admits, hey, I masturbated. And I masturbate. And she thought it was so shameful. Her lover was like, yeah, I do too. It's fine. And that kind of radicalized her. So she became this, during the second wave feminist movement, this woman who was promoting masturbation, which is not what Betty Friedan wanted people to promote. She was like, boardroom, not bedroom. And Jesus, like, in the bedroom, don't talk about masturbation. Talk about, you know, partner. It was very threatening.
Right. And so we're talking, this is what, 1970-ish, right around there?
1960s, 1970s, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And at this time, people certainly were not talking or admitting that they masturbated. You know, that's another whole story, the history of masturbation, which I'll do another time. But, yeah. You know, for Betty Dodson to be out there and talking about this was, as you said, radical.
So 100%.
All right. So then the story goes on. It's not just her hand she's using.
No. And so one day her lover brings home a vibrator. And it was a vibrator. They don't sell money today, but it was one that they strap to your hand so that your fingers actually vibrate. And her lover was in the barbershop and his barber had used this to massage his neck. And this is in the 1960s. And he starts using it on her and she's like, ooh, this feels good. And she really, really liked it. So she starts experimenting with other vibrators that you could buy at Sears still.
Which were sold as massagers, not vibrators.
Right. So they were sold as massagers and as non-sexual things, but she starts putting them on her clitoris and she's like, wow, I'm having these orgasms. I need to tell everybody about it.
You gotta love Betty Dodson. You
know? Yeah. No, she was amazing. And so she's an artist. So she starts painting pictures and drawings of herself using, vibrators that were marketed as back massagers, not as sex toys, and of her friends and lovers using it. And this caused, she was bisexual. So this causes a huge scandal because she's this big art show in New York and it's women masturbating with vibrators and people are like, oh my God. But she goes beyond that to actually having these workshops where she called them body sex workshops, where she, everyone had to attend the workshop nude or take off their clothes right when they started. They sit around in a circle. She talked to women about all the different kinds of vulvas they could have, trying to normalize that because people thought if they had big labia, it was unattractive and something was wrong with them. And then she talked to women about masturbation. She showed them how to masturbate with a lot of times it was a Hitachi magic wand. And then she had women do that as well. And it was like an elevated circle jerk for women, but it was really, really profound at this time.
I'm curious today. I actually never asked this before, but did she charge women for this? Was she entrepreneurial? Was she making money with this? Or this was just, she was out there spreading the good word?
She was charging. She was a smart woman.
So she was an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the Hitachi wand, which is another interesting part of this story, because the Hitachi wand, I mean, that was around in the early 1900s, and it's still one of the most popular devices out there. And like all these other things, it was originally marketed as a massager. But starting in the 70s, it started to be sold as, you know, a sex toy in sex toy stores. And that was a lot because of Betty Dodson, correct?
Absolutely. But the Hitachi company did not like that. They never commented on it.
Even though it sold gazillions of them.
Yes. Yeah. And so now Hitachi has taken its name off of it. Now it's the magic wand. And now they're admitting sexual uses now that Hitachi isn't officially associated with it.
But I thought that was like really recent. I mean, like in the last 10 years that they finally publicly admitted that this magic wand is for sex, not just for massaging your neck.
Absolutely. Way years, decades after Betty Dodson was literally heralding it at National Organization of Women. Use this. You can free yourself from economic and sexual dependence on men with a Hitachi magic wand. Decades after that, they were like, oh yeah, you can do that.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think that Betty Friedan and the other feminists would have embraced this. The idea of you don't need a man, whether it's in the boardroom or in the bedroom, that you can have pleasure and have power without a penis in your life. I mean, that was kind of the early feminist movement, women's lib movement.
Yeah, you would think, but
they did not.
They didn't.
Yeah. All right. So then, you know, we get into the 1980s and we have for the first time, you know, the relatively sex positive Masters and Johnson, who used vibrators when they were doing their research on orgasm. Yet having said that, they wrote in their book that vibrators are a last resort. They did not recommend them other than for treatment of very specific conditions, but that they should not be used as part of a normal, quote, marital aid, correct?
Yeah, they were not super pro-vibrator.
Yeah. And the medical establishment wasn't. I mean, the word was that vibrators are harmful, that they're only used by dysfunctional women, and that they would become vibrator dependent, which, as I talk about in my episode on the science behind vibrators, vibrators don't make women vibrator dependent. Some people are dependent on vibrators because their nerve endings don't respond otherwise, but it wasn't the vibrator that made them that way. So, you know, but it is interesting that we have in the 80s, which was like yesterday. I mean, it's basically doctors saying, don't do this, don't do this. And then in 1998, that was the year that the rabbit made its debut on Sex and the City. And you know, that really changed things too, don't you think?
100%. Charlotte getting, although it was portrayed in a negative way, but that's not how viewers saw it. Charlotte getting addicted to her rabbit. Yes, people saw it and were like, where can I buy this?
Right. I mean, that's, I think, when sales really started to take off. And more important, it became part of the conversation. I mean, I think that's really what that episode did, is that it still, was considered to be something that you hide, that you don't talk about. And all of a sudden, women were talking about it and saying, oh, do you have one of these? And where did you buy yours? And then there started to be nice little sex shops that were not male. Most sex shops, of course, were really intended for gay men, and that they started carrying products for women, but women never felt particularly comfortable buying products there. And I think that it was really around 2000 that really started to change.
Right.
Which brings me back to you, because when in the beginning of your book, you start your book by talking about in 2004, when as a young woman, you were selling sex toys, which is kind of fun and interesting, because one of the things I talk about in my Come Again podcast episode is my daughter, Rachel Czar, who has a PhD in clinical sexology. And I included her in that episode to talk about how to get, you know, a reluctant partner on board and all that kind of stuff. But one of her first jobs was working in a sex toy store, selling vibrators and dildos. I think the only difference is I helped her get that job. I'm betting your mother didn't help you get your job, right?
No. she was not happy about it.
Yeah. But one of the reasons she wasn't happy about it, was it because it was illegal to do what you were doing and she was worried that you were going to end up in jail? Or was it because she just was uncomfortable with the whole sexual nature of it? Or was it both?
It was both, but it was the illegality. Like, she was really scared because someone from my company did end up in jail. And that was,
we were
like
in Texas then, right?
Yes.
Because I talked about that in my other episode about the fact that in Texas it is still on the books, so you can only own 6 vibrators, and the fact that there were people that were arrested for selling vibrators at home parties. But that's exactly what you were doing. You were selling vibrators at home parties, right?
Right. That was what I was doing. And Texas is bringing these laws, trying to intensify their sex toy laws and ban them from CVSs right now. Texas is always like fighting against sex toys. It's crazy.
Which is amazing, because Texas is a state where it's easiest to buy as many guns as you want, just saying, but
right,
it's very, very difficult to buy vibrators. So tell us a little bit about it. It was funny. I loved what you wrote about when you were selling your sex toys in Texas. What was that experience like?
Oh yeah. So it was crazy, because part of our training was because selling sex toys in Texas was illegal, the only way you could do it was by not saying the word vibrator, not saying the word massager, and not saying what you actually could use sex toys before.
So sounds like Victorian times to me.
Exactly. And this is 2004. And so a big part of our training was euphemisms. And it was like scary. They're like, okay, so now don't say the word clitoris when you're talking about when you're trying to convince someone to buy a vibrator. You can't say clitoris. You have to say man in the boat. And and it's like that, what? I mean, I'd never even heard that, but I tried it. At my first, I was like, well, you can use this for on the man in the boat, and you can, you know, wash yourself out to sea. Like, I didn't know what, and people were so confused. It made no sense. It is confusing. And so a lot of the training was that, and we weren't supposed to say orgasm. We were supposed to say like, have fun, enjoy. Like, it was crazy. And so my first time selling, I was at this house. I went to this person's house. It was all female nurses. And they were like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And I abandoned all the training and just used real terms. And yeah, it was a real learning experience. But it made me realize, too, that like, we are terrified of naming sexual body parts, of talking about women's orgasms. And even when your job is to do that, you legally cannot do it. And it was really freaky. And so it changed my whole view of female sexuality and sex toys in a bad way.
The other point that you make that I think is really important is that when you were selling these sex toys to these women, it was really under the umbrella of, you need to buy these toys to improve your marriage as opposed to personal pleasure.
Yes, that was so disturbing to me. And I did not realize that. And all the brochures were about like, okay, if you can understand how to masturbate better, you can please your husband better. If you can understand your body better, then you are going to have a better heterosexual monogamous sex life. And that, and a lot of times they'd even mention masturbation and they would have these, like a rabbit vibrator or something extremely phallic. And they'll be like, you can use this with your husband. He'll love it. I'm like, will he? Like, I don't know.
But you know, what's so funny is now we, in a lot of ways, have the opposite problem, which is one of the things I address on Come Again, is that women have this idea that, well, it's okay to use a vibrator when I masturbate, when I'm on my own, but to introduce it into partnered sex is a little uncomfortable because it's something, you know, he might not accept, or their female partner might not accept, because it's kind of, you know, doing the job for them. So it's really have flipped the script, but is problematic in a different way.
That's fascinating, actually. So it's like the shame, or not the shame, but like, it's like, it's seen as a critique of the partner's sexual skills or something.
That's what they think it is. Most guys are grateful, but you know, but the women worry about that. But you know, the other thing too, you talk about shame. I mean, we think we've come a long way, and in many ways we have. I mean, vibrators are sold openly in corner drug stores, unless of course you live in Texas. You can have one delivered same day from Amazon. But having said that, I mean, how many women leave their vibrators on, you know, right at their bedside table next to their sleep mask and their box of Kleenex? They don't. They hide them, right? So have we really come that far? Are people still ashamed of the fact that they are buying an implement to help them have pleasure?
I think there's still a lot of shame there. I think you pointed it out correctly. Like, people do hide their vibrators. People don't talk to, you know, their doctors about sex orgasms, like women and men. And I think a big part of the shame too is you can't advertise them as openly as you could in the early 1900s. So like TikTok bans ads for vibrators, Meta, so Instagram and Facebook do. And so there's a lot of restriction. I think Google ads do as well. But you can advertise erectile dysfunction medication. So again, there's this double standard where it's like, okay, men's sexuality, we can talk about openly. It's necessary. Women's is literally banned from very popular corners of the internet.
Well, and not to mention that we still have these laws on the books, not just in Texas, but in other states as well. The obscenity laws can be interpreted in many different ways. And it's highly problematic because there are parts of Georgia that you can't get a vibrator without a prescription, and, you know, Alabama, and because of what's going on now, like you said, it's likely to get worse, not better. You know, this whole idea of the only, you know, we're going back to the dark ages of the only reason to have sex is for procreation in this, you know, forced baby making world that we're in right now. So, it's real interesting. And I always like talking to historians, because the beauty of talking to historians is, because you know the past, I think you're much better at predicting the future. So where do you think we're going?
Oh, it is depressing, because so where we're going, like right now, and I'm sure you're familiar with all the age verification laws to watch for throughout the nation. They are trying to age gate vibrators as well in some states on websites, so in sex toys. So there's more of that restriction. There's an anti-sex attitude in our culture right now. Lots of, you know, laws restricting gender and sex. So that's all the unfortunate side of things. So right now we're in this sexual repression era. But I think in a way, it's really hard to put the vibrator back in the box or put the sex toys in. Like, there's so much more awareness now that, yes, you will have government coming down on this in a way, but I think people are still, there's, you know, more awareness that these can improve your relationships. The sex toys can improve your relationships and your life and provide more pleasure. And there's cool sex toy innovations right now too.
There's all kinds of cool sex toy innovations. Yeah. And on my Substack, I do have a guide to buying vibrators with all these innovations out there. But also in my world, as I point out, yes, vibrators and other sex toys can make sex more fun and more pleasurable. But in my world, it's also to make orgasms possible, because when you have women who have medical problems like, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes and multiple sclerosis, their nerve endings are such that they simply do not respond without vibration. So, yeah, there's a whole different reason why it's so important that we keep vibrators in the mainstream as not something that's just, hey, this is kind of fun, but as, which would be fine in and of itself, but it's also something that is really medically necessary. You know, there's just so much more. When I was rereading this book, and I just thought we could do like 12 episodes on this, but but it really is fascinating, because the history of the vibrator is really the history of the patriarchy. It's the history of the differences between male and female sexuality and the law, you know, everything that's changed with that. There's just so much. I do want to encourage everyone to read your book, which of course I'll have the link in the program notes. But before we want to finish up here, I want to talk about your current project, because it's also really, really interesting. And along the same line, it's about women and sexual pleasure, because your new book, and I want to hear more about it when it's coming out and everything, is on the history of gigolos, you know, male sex workers, female clients. So can you give us a sneak preview of what you're working on now?
Yeah. So my book is coming out next year with Beacon Press, and it is about the history and current state of gigolos. Yeah. And it is like a continuation of my arguments, like in Buzz, like women have a right to sexual pleasure. And some of that sexual pleasure involves paid sexual pleasure, which in the U.S. is illegal. But even though it's illegal here in a patriarchy, when things are illegal, they're still available for the people in power. They're still available for the straight men.
Yeah, always, always.
Always. And so there's like literally a brothel in every corner in the U.S. for straight men, and they're called massage parlors. Women want this.
Happy ending.
Happy ending. And women actually enjoy and have happy ending massages, but they have less opportunity to do that in here. So in the U.S., because the structure of the society is made for male sexual pleasure. So I talk a lot about the women and men who are, you know, women who are customers and why they're going to see gigolos. And a lot of times, just like with vibrator, sometimes gigolos have bought people their first orgasm. Some women are going to gigolos to lose their virginity. One story in there, it's a stepmom bringing her stepdaughter, buying her a gigolo so she can lose her virginity. And so it's this other side. The side we're seeing now is the Diddy trial, where people are kind of like weaponizing Diddy was buying male escorts for his girlfriend, and she didn't, you know, there was like not consent and everything necessarily. But yeah, I'm talking about the side where it's women.
We're talking consensual.
Yeah.
But the other thing, so because my audience tends to be the over 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 crowd, how often, and is there any data on older women who hire a gigolo because either they have no partner or because their partner has lost interest or can't maintain an erection or be sexual with them?
Oh my God. I'm so glad you asked that, because those are like the biggest number of gigolo clients are women over 40, women up into their 80s.
Yeah, and those are the women who could afford it, first of all.
Right. And that's a huge issue too, about like affordability, because gigolos are expensive. But yes, there are women who are widows who are or just wanting to experience something new, and they are not wanting to go into the dating scene because the dating scene, you know, you don't know what you're getting. It's not safe. Maybe the person isn't skilled, or maybe they just want a younger guy, just like, you know, men want a younger, hot woman, and that's fine too. And so you have a lot of older ladies doing that. And there, I talked to gigolos who said, you know, I had a client and her husband had never gone down on her. He thought that was something a real man didn't do. So she was in her 80s and specifically came to me and was like, I want that. And she loved it.
All right. So one last question, because I know I'm going to get this question. So I'm going to ask you, where do women find gigolos who are, you know, women who are in their, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, where do they find these guys that they're willing to pay for and want to have in their life, but obviously want to be safe as well? Is there like an app? I mean,
there. Okay, so since it's technically illegal, there isn't an app, but Cowboys for Angels is one of the big agencies, and that they're hiring. They're not openly sexual. They're hiring escorts for the time. Those are straight male escorts for women. Thumbtack is another place people have gone to for escorts. It's like a service to help get stuff fixed around your house.
Something fixed around your house. I love it. Yeah. You move that couch and fix my leaky faucet, and while you're at it, go down on me. I mean, really?
Right. And Tryst.com is another site that actually has some, but they're few and far between. Twitter's another place you can go. Yeah, because it's illegal, and that's a whole other issue about sex work. But right. But yeah.
I'm going to have you back when that book comes out.
Oh, great,
out.
So, great.
Thank you for the sneak preview, because I think that that is fascinating. And thank you for spending this time with me. I love talking to you. Again, I encourage everyone to read your book. It is a great read. It is really, really wonderful. And for everyone, be sure to check out my episode on Come Again, The Science of Why Vibrators Work When Nothing Else Does, including the chat with Dr. Rachel Zarr on how to get your reluctant partner on board. So thank you, Haley.
Thank you so much. This was great.